The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okie doke. We've been talking about beginning to discuss the functions of the city or the images of the city. And last time we talked about the city as a centralizing place. Now I wanted to give you a second function of the city or image of the city. So this would be number two. And that is the idea of mobility. In the rural-urban continuum, not a polarization, but in the connections, there is mobility in the village. There is mobility in the small town as well. Things aren't just forever static in a place like that. In the past, I think that has been over-exaggerated. But as you move into the city, this mobility becomes more pronounced. So rural areas often tend to be relatively fixed, relatively static. They don't change quickly. Small towns don't change much. I think this is also a reason why usually in a rural area, someone who goes there from the outside to be pastor will often find you can be in that neighborhood for 10 years and they will still regard you as a newcomer because you don't have your roots there. It takes longer for a pastor to fit into a rural area than a city area, just because of this kind of mentality. So the lifestyle of the rural and small town areas often reflect this. The lifestyles are often conservative, very resistant to any outside change, especially change that is radical in nature. So rural areas often become protectors. They become preservers of traditional religion. I think a good example of that here in the United States is the Bible Belt. The Bible Belt is often associated with the rural South. And people in the Bible Belt get very quickly upset when traditional ideas are questioned. I think that's not necessarily characteristic of the South. It's very characteristic, though, of more conservative, small areas. Am I right, Jean? But the image of the city is an image of shift, of change, of new ideas, new methods, new lifestyles. The city allows people more room for change. And in the book that you're reading by Edward Krupat on page 70, he says, the city provides alternative routes to a given destination. Now, I think this characteristic of mobility is very important for church planning. And I want to mention some of the at least five characteristics for church growth. Number one, church growth is more likely to take place at a faster pace in rapidly developing, changing cities. And in cities, rapidly developing cities, more than cities where the pace of change is slower. In other words, we're saying that that a growing city is usually more receptive to the gospel than a static city or a declining city. I think part of it is because in the city, people are more willing to consider new ideas. They're more open to change. And Christianity is perceived as a religion that offers alternative. So they're in a mindset that is ready to change. They're constantly hearing new ideas. And then you see Christianity as one more new idea. For example, I was at a conference a few years ago in the Netherlands on dealing with Muslim evangelization. And I was asked to read a paper on Muslim urbanization. And there was a large number of people there who were coming from all over the world to, it was a Lausanne-sponsored meeting dealing with this topic of Muslim evangelism. And there was very strong support of what I'm saying now. And the argument was, for example, that many of the missionaries who were there and those who had experience in Muslim cities commented that in a rural area or a small village that's Muslim, it is very difficult to break away from the community because the community and the village are virtually the same. There's no room for opportunity, no room for being a little loose. But if the same Muslim goes into the city, to that extent, the community is not as strong around him. And he or she finds more room to think about Christianity. So we're finding now, for example, that many of the Bible correspondence courses now being read and studied by Muslims. They're being sent to Muslims in cities, not rural areas. Because the rural area is more of a protection against change. In Japan, the church has grown scarcely at all in the villages. If you look at a very different picture from Korea, but there is almost no church growth in the villages of Japan. And what growth there is in the Japanese church has come from converted people, city dwellers. So there is a very sharp distinction, or a very clear distinction between the churches that have grown up in the city and churches that have grown up in the village. It's almost like night and day. There's such a difference. Now, in Japan, the church is not very large anywhere, but it is much larger in the city than in the villages. Further, in Japan, church growth is much stronger and much faster in cities that are growing rapidly. For example, in the south, to the south of Tokyo is Kobe. Kobe is... there are churches in Kobe, but there are not nearly as many churches in Kobe as there are in Tokyo. And it's more than just the fact that there are more people in Tokyo than in Kobe. It's also the style of the city. Tokyo is rapid movement, things changing all the time, something new going on. Kobe is a very traditional city. It's a large city, but still relatively quiet. So I think there's also a difference between styles of cities. For example, I There's a difference. There's a difference between the style of Philadelphia and almost any other city of the same size in the United States. Dr. Logan, I think, pointed a book out to me, which I haven't read, a comparison of Boston and Philadelphia. And the title of the book is, I think, significant, Puritan Boston and Quaker Philadelphia. The roots of Philadelphia were not with the Puritans, but with the Quakers. And I think as a result of that, partly the result of that, Philadelphia's style is much quieter. There's not as much movement as there would be. People are always making jokes about how quiet life is in Philadelphia. One of the famous comedians of many decades ago was W.C. Fields, and he was always making jokes about Philadelphia. He said that when he died, he would have put on his tombstone these words: "As a whole, I'd rather be in Philadelphia." He was not very positive about Philadelphia. Or people will talk about winning a contest, and the first prize was 1 week in Philadelphia, and the second prize was 2 weeks in Philadelphia. And I think part of it is just because of the style of the city. It's quieter. If some of you have visited New York City, for example, or Washington, D.C., it's very, very, as some of you know, it's very different style. In New York City, life stops around 5 a.m. In Philadelphia, that's when it begins. Just very different. So I think you can expect to see in cities that are moving fast, where there's big change and things are ripping along, there's where you may see church growth. And it will be faster than the quieter cities. I think that, to my mind, that underlines the need for, if you're thinking about mission strategy and church planning, you put priority on the so-called two-thirds world cities, because that's where growth right now is almost fantastic. American cities have, for the last 20 years, have pretty much now leveled off. They're not growing rapidly, except in Sun Belt areas, in Arizona, Texas, New Mexico. And now, because of financial crunch, even those cities are slowing down. The difference, though, as you're already reading and know, in so-called third world cities, the difference is fantastic. Rapid, rapid urbanization. And that offers great potential for church growth. The second point I would make also, in terms of strategy for church growth, you can also expect, based on this idea of mobility, you may also expect more church growth in changing neighborhoods of a city rather than in neighborhoods that are stable. So, for example, if here's one city and you have two neighborhoods, one neighborhood population has not moved much, very stable neighborhood, not many people moving in, not many people moving out. On the other hand, here's another neighborhood. At first, it seems very frightening because the population shifting all the time. I think, what do they say now? In the United States, each person moves an average of once every 5 years. So here's a neighborhood where it seems like everybody's moving every 6 months. Which neighborhood will you go to? And you think, oh, I'll go to the stable neighborhood. You can build a solid, stable church. No, you'll build a solid, dying church. You go to a neighborhood where things are moving all the time, because there you have great potential for people. They're coming, going all the time. I visited a church a few years ago in Washington, D.C. In fact, some of you know the name of Steve Smallman. He's been a student here at Westminster. He graduated, I guess, last May. His father is the pastor of this church. And it's in McLean, Virginia, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. And I was talking to some of the members of the church during the weekend. That church has rapid turnover because a very, very large percentage of the members of the church work for the government. And so the government changes every 4 years. They have a job for 4 years. There's a new government administration. Bang, out they go. There is a constant struggle for discipling, for training people, because they come and go so quickly. But if you visit the church, it's constantly growing. I would imagine if they kept all of the people that during a 10-year period went through that church, they would probably have a church 4 or 5 times as large as they have now. But they are growing. Why? Because they're in a dynamic, changing neighborhood. The vice president attends that church now, and several other administrators of a certain political administration. But at any rate, it's I think that's very characteristic. Further, even stable cities, we talked about changing cities and more or less stable cities. Even static or declining cities, like Philadelphia, will have neighborhoods that are growing or in the process of change. So don't make your decision about whether you go to the city or not, and whether the city is quiet. You look around also in the city for neighborhoods that are shifting. I was talking to Bill Crispin last week, and we were talking about a neighborhood in Philadelphia that some of us have done surveys in, a place called Northern Liberties in North Philadelphia. And there was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer just a couple of weeks ago. This neighborhood, which is located near the Delaware River and just north of the center of the city, this neighborhood is connected as North Philadelphia, with almost surrounded, except by the river, by some of the lowest income housing in the city of Philadelphia. And yet, I can remember that class we had, and I think Helen Peck was saying that she works in a church just about 7 or 8 blocks from Northern Liberties. And in her neighborhood, you can buy a 3-story row house for something like $5,000. 7 or 8 blocks away in Northern Liberties, you buy the same property and it'll cost you $150,000. Because of what's happening is that the yuppies are now pouring into Northern Liberties. There was an article in Inquirer just a couple of weeks ago on the yuppification of Northern Liberties. Well, there is a changing neighborhood, changing very rapidly. Whether anybody in that neighborhood is going to take advantage of that and plant a yuppie church, I don't know. Because they're not going to go to the churches that exist in the neighborhood. A different kind of church will have to be created. But you look for neighborhoods that change. Slum neighborhoods, shanty towns, may offer tremendous potential for church growth. Right now in Philadelphia, the Hispanic community, the Hispanic population, is moving at an accelerated rate into the area above Roosevelt Boulevard, into the area above Route 1, an area, Logan Olney area. The Hispanic community formerly kept south of the boulevard. Now there's more and more indication that they're crossing the boulevard and moving north, going into the area that often has had large numbers of Chinese and Korean population. What's happening? Well, I think that now is the time to plant churches in those areas to reach that population. And in fact, some of you know Dr. Ortiz has started the work, and they now have three churches located in that area in just 2 years. But you ask yourself, where are the neighborhoods that are changing and shifting? I can remember just several years ago in the church that where we worship, Emmanuel Chapel, they had a Sunday afternoon Korean worship service, and their effort was to have English language service in the morning, Korean worship service in the afternoon, and then in between they would have a Sunday school so that the Korean children could get teaching in English. And they tried to have one church, not two churches, but one. It wasn't just a case of letting Koreans rent the building. It was one congregation. The Korean part of the congregation died. It died, I guess, maybe 3-4 years ago. And I could see it slowly getting smaller and smaller. Why did it? Well, there's no Koreans in South Philadelphia. You've got Koreans in Logan. You've got more well-to-do Koreans then move quickly out of Logan. They head for the suburbs like Ambler, Horsham, North Hills, Lansdale. But you don't find Koreans in South Philadelphia. So if you're going to plant a church, you plant a church where there's mobility and where things are changing. One of the factors in this, at least, I think there is an adjustment, let's say, in a country like Zaire or in a place like Brazil. There are adjustments that a rural person must make when they move into the city. But those adjustments, though they have to be made, they're not terribly radical. Part of that is because there is a difference in how people migrate to the city. In the United States, generally, the movement might be called just one-step migration. I live in Boise, Idaho. My boss says, you're going to go to work in Boston, Massachusetts, because we need you there. So you jump from Boise, Idaho to Boston, Massachusetts. During vacation time, you don't go back to Boise, Idaho. You have made the break once and for all. Maybe you left a child there who got married. You go see them now once every so often, but you don't belong to Boise, Idaho. But in Brazil, in Zaire, many places in the world, you have what is called step migration. Where the migration pattern is somewhat different than in the United States. You start in a small town. Then you take a step to maybe a larger town. Then another step and another step. So you may move to a very large city, but you will move not in one big step, but maybe several. Further, you do not make breaks with what you left behind. So if you're moving from your farm in northern South Africa and you're going to Johannesburg, when you will go back to the farm when it's time to harvest, you don't sell the land because the land is you. So you plant, you harvest, you go back to visit your family because that's where your roots are. I think that's very characteristic on the world. So the migration pattern is not as severe. I think another thing that modifies what I'd say also is that I've mentioned slums and shanty towns. There are slums and there are slums. Some scholars make a difference between a slum and a shanty town. And there are some scholars who will argue that the term shanty town is used to describe a relatively stable lower class area where the houses always look poor, where people build little houses out of packing crates and they live in them for year after year after year. But slums have a tendency, because there's so much vitality in the slum. You may find, for example, that you see a slum on the edge of Nairobi, and you go back 5 years later and the slum isn't there. People have started building houses out of cement blocks, and they put tin roofs on. And you go back 5 years later and the cement blocks are gone. Now there's a one-story house with a nice tile roof. slums move up. And I guess what I'm saying is that if you move into a shanty town, as it were, a place where poor people live, but there's no movement, the chances, the prospects of growth for the church will not be as strong there as they might be in a very bad slum, which is constantly changing and moving. I remember Roger Greenway once being asked, what would you look for if you wanted to plant a church? Greenway said, I'll look for a neighborhood where there are no paved roads, where they're just mud roads, and maybe where there are no buses yet, or maybe one or two buses are beginning to come in. In other words, the city, that part of the city is beginning to grow. It's beginning to move. And there's enough indication of movement there that the city is now going to send a bus line there. And maybe they're talking about paving the roads. But you get there and plant a church before they pave the road. And then you become part of the process of movement. So I think that's still true. I would, if I, thinking of the social class, that social class element in terms of what we're talking about, yeah. I think it's that's a very important element, and if I think it's theologically true in terms of strategy, as you just said, that it's harder for rich men to enter the kingdom of heaven, and that means then that presumably in those neighborhoods which are experiencing rapid change, but which are, to use the current vernacular, are gentrifying. You may not expect to see a lot of growth there for the church unless the church is willing to radically modify its style to reach that gentrifying neighborhood. If you're an old-fashioned church and you've been this way for a long time and this is your neighborhood, suddenly all of these yuppies start coming in, the neighborhood starts getting gentrified, you tend to want to stay with your style. But your style will not be attractive to the yuppie.
What practically, what sort of adaptations would you achieve?
Well, for example, I think there'll have to be radical adaptations in terms of the music of the church. They're not going to sing out of the hymn book that that 70-year-old woman has learned to appreciate. They won't be interested in Dwight L. Moody and Ira Sankey. They'll probably enjoy scripture songs. They'll enjoy gospel songs. We've been worshiping on and off for the last couple of months at a local New Life church, and it's interesting. You sit back there and sort of saying, "You so what's going on here?" And the first half an hour is, you know, everything's up on the overhead projector. You don't use books, all the songs are praise songs, frequent repetition of the language, simple lines repeated over and over again. The music is very contemporary. I think that's part of the reason why New Life churches reach the kind of people they reach. I think also there would have to be modifications in the preaching style. One of the recent phenomena in American life are the growth of these things called mega churches, where you've got churches like the Walnut Creek Church in the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois. Pastor there is Bill Hybels. You have several large churches like that in California. Why do they grow like that? They have big parking lots. Why? Because they know that a church like that will not be a walk-in church. It will be a mobile church. People are willing to come as yuppies from an hour away if they can come to a church that they enjoy. The style, Bill Hybels talks about the style they've adopted at Walnut Creek Church. So the style of the preaching is, from what he describes it, it's biblical, but there's a very strong emphasis on application. They avoid trying to use traditional theological language and try to use language in the preaching and teaching that is current. So I think all those things then change. I've noticed also, for example, in connection with the music, there is a very active, dynamic congregation in California, Southern California, Congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America, started a few years ago by one of our alumnus. And that congregation, the pastor has a couple of years ago wrote up the history of how that church is growing. Massive, rapid church growth. How did they do it? He said the first person they hired after the pastor was a professional musician. They did not hire an assistant pastor. They didn't hire a youth worker. They hired a professional musician who wrote their music, who led their choirs. And he was very strong in insisting that professional music will be very core to reaching yuppies. I think Heibels is an example of that. John Wimber and the Vineyard Movement. John Wimber is a professional musician. And the music and style of the church is professional. The congregation I mentioned in Southern California, the PCA Church, they also use drama. The church in Walnut Creek, Bill Heibel's church, apparently makes use of drama in the worship service. And the whole idea is develop a style that will communicate to today's people the old gospel. I think that those would be some of the differences. And I'm sure there are many others, but please, James.
I heard a lot of good results. But I saw the picture in your the magazine, PCA magazine. You didn't have any religion in front of him. The only thing he was holding was the Bible.
Yeah.
There was nothing on the front. And
yeah.
I heard that his stuff was very, very unusual, unique.
Yeah.
And that really attracted so many. Right now, there's like 400 people.
Yeah, it's a huge church now already. I heard also, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard, for example, that they now have three worship services and that each one follows a different pattern. So they will have one service, which is, you know, traditional, that would be characteristic of all our churches. You know, the hymn book favorites and the, you know, the regular order of service. Then he has another service, which is totally contemporary, and he wears jeans. He'll have a radio mic, so he doesn't have to carry anything in his hand or stand behind a box. There'll be electronic music, guitars, etc. Then there's a third service where he uses the Book of Common Prayer, and where the worship service becomes almost Episcopalian in style. He has three different kinds of people coming to those churches, and it's working. But you have to wrestle with congregations have got to be different to reach different kinds of people. I think in a sense too, you know, that to my mind that whole the significance of worship style also fits in with this whole idea of the city as one of rapid mobility. If you're going to reach people in the city, depending on your decisions, you may have to develop all kinds of flexibility in terms of the worship. And you may find it's easier to have several different kinds of worship services than to have just one service with it all mixed in. Otherwise, you get something like Irish stew or what you'd call in Korea bibimbap, you know, all mixed in together. That doesn't work well. I think, for example, I could argue, number one, because that's the way churches grow. That is simply the way churches are. I have very seldom ever been in a church where I find mixed into that one congregation the very poor and the middle class and the very rich. In fact, I can only think of one church where I've ever been in where that's happened. You may have churches where almost all the people are very poor, or churches in the United States where most people are maybe middle class or upper class, but you'll find that. Why is that so? Well, because part of it is because that's how the neighborhoods are in the United States. You have neighborhoods which are not neighborhoods where the very wealthy and the very poor mix together. You have neighborhoods like where Jean and her husband are pastoring, where the these are working class neighborhoods. And now, if Jean and Dan work in that Methodist church in Manayunk and Roxborough, and they can't get any yuppies to come to the church, or they can't get any blacks to come to the church, or they can't get any poor, have they failed in their responsibility to plant a church? No, they haven't, because that's the neighborhood God's given to them. That's what they're trying to do. You can have churches. I think churches that reflect different social classes are generally possible only the higher up you go on the social scale. Because if you're in a poor neighborhood, most people don't have cars. They can't drive to their favorite church an hour away. They can't be like Walnut Creek Bible Church and drive all the way across Chicago to get there. They don't have a vehicle. So the churches often in an American city like Philadelphia are storefront churches. And they're storefront churches fulfilling a real need because people can walk to that storefront church. It's within a few blocks of their area. Immediately then, you have restricted the social character of that church just because of the neighborhood you're in, because of whether people have cars or not. I can remember a few years ago, one of our students here was a missionary in South Africa, and Bill Weber, and he took several courses with us, and he was talking about his hoax. I think he was working in Cape Town, and he wanted to plant a church that in a South African context would be multi-ethnic. And but he was very well aware of the tremendous problems that existed in doing it, and among all the other problems, just simply the logistic ones. And he was describing, of course, a situation that existed 7 or 8 years ago in South Africa. I don't know what it's like now. But he said, how can I do that? He said, I'll have to find a church, presumably that will be located close to an edge of a neighborhood, so that if I locate the building too far into the white neighborhood, blacks and coloreds can't get to it. And somebody said, well, why couldn't they? And he said, because blacks and coloreds probably don't have vehicles. They don't have their own cars. And you don't have buses and public transportation on Sunday. It's a Sabbath day. So if they're in a colored area and they want to go to that integrated church, they're going to have to walk 10 miles to get there. Now, is Bill Weber wrong for wanting to do that? Not at all. But he's also very realistic. So I think you have to take these things into consideration. I think also, if you define the word church only in terms of this one local body of believers, then I think your criticism or your comments are good ones. But it seems to me if you're seeing the church as something bigger than that, then you can allow or You must create situations where that church, like a presbytery or a church in a regional area, can find ways to express its oneness, can get together, maybe get together on a periodic basis for joint worship, poor, middle class, upper, all together to say we belong together in Jesus. But to expect that to function in one single church unit, I think is very difficult. Sorry. And I would suggest that 1 Corinthians gives you an example of how difficult it is. I think one of the things that encourages me about the things, for example, I don't know enough about what Tim Keller's doing in New York to judge this, but I have high respect for what I think he would do. In Southern California, in the model I mentioned from the Presbyterian Church in America, I asked that pastor, since they were very obviously directly orienting their ministry to yuppies. I said, what do you do about the poor? What do you teach these people? And he said, well, those are among the first things we teach them. These are the obligations of Christian discipleship. What as a wealthy person, what is your obligation towards the poor? Really, I think that's where part of the focus should be. But let me say one or two things, which I think I've just forgotten. One thing I think I'd say is that I have just received a call to pastor the Huntington Valley Church, and I go to Huntington Valley and I find that the average income of the members of that church is $100,000 a month. I probably immediately think they made a mistake, and they didn't. There was a mistake when they sent the mail out, and they were probably calling Harvey Cox, not Harvey Kahn. But I would ask that. But I think as a minister of the gospel, I think you've got to give anybody, whether very wealthy or very poor, a balanced diet. And I think you could get into a lot of trouble if Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, all you told them was, don't forget the poor, give up your wealth to the poor. I think after a while that would probably irritate even people who were poor. I also say as a pastor, the gospel is good news. You don't go in and get people offended and say, I preach the gospel. Talking to the rich and wealthy about the use of their wealth in the kingdom must become to them a genuine call to repent, not just feel guilty. And I think there's a difference here. I think often here's Judas Iscariot and Peter. Judas wept, Peter wept. But I think the difference was Judas wept because of his guilt, and he had no place to take his guilt. So out of guilt, he committed suicide. Peter repented of his guilt. Somehow or other, then our task in preaching is not just make people feel guilty about their wealth or feel guilty about the fact they don't have wealth. But with the call to repentance, there must be the offering of new direction, new change, so that there's a sense in which we can overdo pounding on one thing too long. I'm not saying not do it, but I'm just saying remember, I think the balance is needed. Part of the call to discipleship of a church, no matter whether it's made up of poor people or middle class or wealthy, is also a call to moderation, to the simple lifestyle. And I think that's another place where a church has relatively affluent members is going to wrestle very hard with the nature of the gospel. Let your moderation be known unto all men, the Lord is at hand. Christ's call to live a simple lifestyle for the sake of the poor and the kingdom of God is a very rich demand. That also ought to be part of the teaching of the church, and very often isn't. Again, I think, though, I won't say any more. Let's take a break, and we can come back and keep at it. For example, in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia, as you move past 40th Street, 45th Street, and you're moving out in that direction, outside of the circle surrounding the University of Pennsylvania, Drexel University, you get past 50th Street. There you begin to see very desperate areas, slum areas. Usually, I think we tend to... In often I think people simply will talk about slums and shanty towns as if they're the same, but there are differences. There is a book published some years ago by a British scholar named Peter Lloyd. It's a small little paperback. It's called Slums of Hope. And Lloyd points out in his book that there are, he just uses the term like slum, but he says there are two kinds of slums. There is the slum that you enter and you see no change there at all. The buildings get worse. The problems in the neighborhood continue to increase. But he said also you'll find other slums where there is a change going on constantly. There is constant activity. There are children running to school in the streets. There's a whole row of cardboard houses. On the corner, somebody has taken a wooden packing crate and made it into a little store. Then 2 years from now, the little store has become a bigger store. And the houses are becoming more permanent. Those are slums of hope. Those are slums which are correcting or moving upward. And you see, I think particularly many times in, I don't know where they are in Seoul now, but when we were in Korea, in Seoul, and you would see in certain parts of the city, you would see slums where desperately poor people were living. But I go back now and they're middle-class neighborhoods. Those are not slums that remained slums, but they're slums that moved and changed. So there are different kinds of slums. And I think that what we're talking about now are those areas where there is change and movement. And we can expect those are very often good places to plant churches. Those churches will grow. And those churches will reach out to others in the neighborhood as well. I think that's true.